All right. I'm going to go ahead and get started. Just, it's a little past five and thought I won't have enough time to cover what I want to cover. So we're going to go ahead and get it started here. So I know Tim said he couldn't be here. I figured Sam and Steph, I guess that I would have, maybe they didn't hear me this morning. I don't know. Anyway, they're not here, but I'm recording it in case they want to listen to it later on. So the past couple of times we worked on some things, such as memorizing the books of the Bible, the divisions of the Bible, 17 time periods of the Bible. How's everyone feeling about a lot of that? Yeah? So? Feeling good? Good, Grayson. All right. All right, so we're going to get a chance to dive into some of that in just a minute. But just kind of recap real quick. The Bible, we were talking about looking at this from a higher level, right? A 20,000 foot level. Before we can take it apart book by book, we need to understand how it's arranged together, book by book. And so I made this point or this consideration, does not the whole always consist of the parts? And does not the whole help in the comprehension of the parts? And that is always true. And to illustrate that, you might recall a painting that I had over here about how we might take a little piece here and a little piece there, and that's how we sometimes study the Bible. We don't really understand how these pieces fit together. But the more we keep studying and the more we begin to understand the big picture, we begin to see what it is that it was illustrating. And the more we study, the more we dive deeper, we might even see things the second or third time around that we didn't see before. And so that's just a great reminder of it. The need to understand the whole before we really start to understand some of the parts. And so part of what we have been doing is trying to get the big picture of the Bible. One of the ways we do that historically is with the 17 time periods of the Bible. And you might even think about my sermon this morning. Can you remember what I covered? Can you look at these right here and see which of the squares did I cover? Okay, 1 through 5. All right. Well, if you think about it, we might say I did all of them, right? Because it covered the entire scheme of redemption. But if we're to talk about like the references I used, the actual scriptures I went to, what do you think, Nancy? Okay. Good, good. That's right. So Genesis, Exodus. Well, thank you. Thank you. Genesis, Exodus. Right? We got into all of that. We talked a lot about Genesis and Abraham. I talked a little bit about the flood. That's right. You know, Jacob, Isaac and Jacob, and then the 12 tribes, right? The exodus from Egypt, wandering in the wilderness. We talked about that. And then invasion and conquest because Joshua was going to go into the promised land. And we didn't get too much into the rest of this because my goal was to focus on the threefold promise to Abraham, right? And the fulfillment of that threefold promise. So in those sections, we covered the land promise, the nation promise. But then I wanted to get to the seed promise, which then, yes. Do you remember I quoted a passage in the New Testament? Do you remember what it was? I quoted one. No. It was Matthew chapter 1, right? That Jesus would save my people from their sins, right? And so that was the portion I took from the life of Christ. Didn't get into the entire story of Christ. But then I started to go to the early church, right? Galatians. We spent some time in Galatians chapter 3 to show how Paul was connecting the teaching of what was given to Abraham and the seed promise. And then eventually, you know, we get to the letters of the Christians, even the prophecy at the end, Revelation 22. And you see how we drew that whole picture. So that was a high level a viewpoint of the Bible. And if we can understand the whole, then we can begin to understand some of more of the parts, the details. So this is a very, very good chart to help us kind of break it up into segments to picture the whole in just 17 time periods. Okay, so anybody want to try to recite these? Grayson wants to. Go for it. Fantastic, buddy. Fantastic. Anybody else want to try? I know some tried last time, so if you did last time, you don't have to do it again. But anybody else want to give it a go? No? All right. We'll keep working on it because that's something you want to know so you can kind of picture this overall view of the Bible and those 17 time periods. So the other thing we talked about was in understanding the Bible in terms of its divisions, the way in which the books themselves are arranged. So the other one deals more with history, regardless of where the books are at. This one deals more with where the books are placed in the Bible. And we notice that there's five there in the Old Testament, four in the New, right? Five books of law, history, poetry, major prophets, minor prophets, and then four divisions in the New: gospel, history, letters, prophecy. Anyone can remember how many are in each division? Okay, good. That's the Old Testament. Yeah.
22.
Nope.
21.
There you go.
21,
there you go. Good, good. All right. Anybody remember the divisions themselves? In the Old Testament first. Yes.
Law, history, poetry, major and minor prophets.
Very good. Excellent. And now the New Testament. Okay, we just say Gospels, but right, yes, it does cover the life of Christ, yes. Good, good. Very, very good. So those are important that we understand why the books are categorized the way they are in the Bible, because we notice some of these that come maybe later in the Old Testament, chronologically or historically, are back up there in historical time periods. But they're put this way because it's the category of prophets that they're arranged in. And so it just helps us to understand when we actually approach the Bible itself, how it's arranged the way it's arranged. Any comments or questions about this?
So it would make more sense to leave it in chronological order so that you could understand it instead of cycling through it back and forth.
I mean, I can't argue with that. I mean, you know, and they make actually some Bibles that are chronological Bibles that try to do that very thing. But God had his reasons for providentially allowing it to come together in this way. But good point. Good point. Yes, Nancy?
One of the things I think is really important is to tell students and myself that the whole Bible is inspired. Mm-hmm.
Yes, very true. And that's...
You have people to say, well, don't you know the men write the
men? Yes. Right. And that way they can disregard what it tells them to do if they don't believe in its inspiration. We're going to mention something later on in class, though, that while the Bible is inspired, every word was obviously revealed inspired by God, not every word is actually what God is wanting us to do. For example, we talked about this morning where Satan said, you're not going to surely die. Well, that was a true record. It was an inspired record, but that's not actually what God wanted them to do. And so we'll talk about some of that a little bit as well in trying to understand context and who's speaking the words. Yes?
When I started teaching my young children and all, I mean, I understand what Paul's saying, but it also helped me when you're going back and forth, you're learning a lot. Mm-hmm. Going to place other things and saying prophets in this order.
Yeah.
Together and apart and why.
Yeah.
I learned a lot by going back and forth, Paul. You can learn a lot.
True. Well, and
study, it helps you.
And one reason why the way Paul said it is when we usually read something, it's being compiled all together at one time. But the Bible was not compiled together at one time. And so that's, these different prophets lived at different time periods and wrote in different times. And so it was piece by piece, collection after collection, these were arranged in time. But we do see why God places a premium on studying the Word, right? As we often have that little picture, read me on the Bible. Yes, we have to study in order to make the connections. And we begin to put that piece together, like that picture at the beginning. So those are the divisions. Important to know that. And it will help you as well when you come to memorizing the books of the Bible. You know, the particular book. Okay, I know what particular division it fits in. So I then have a particular idea of where it's going to be in the front, beginning, or end of the Old or the New Testament. All right. Anybody want to try to recite the books of the Old Testament? Okay, Nancy.
Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Solomon, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi.
Great. 99% correct. 99% correct. One was left out. I saw some eyes look up. Do you know which one it is?
I know I'm going to like it. Oh, when I have pins scared. You're not supposed to move, so I just put my hands in.
All right. So whoever tells you which one left out, they have to do the books next. Who's going to say it? There you go. You answered it yourself. Yeah. We all do that. You get in a roll, and sometimes it just one slips out. But I knew you knew it. I knew you knew it. Anyone want to try the New Testament books? Anybody? Austin? Should I stare at you a little longer? They were doing it in their class, they said, today, where each person had to do a book, so Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts. And they were saying that's difficult because if someone forgets, then all of a sudden they've lost track of the role of where it is. All right, let's do it together. Ready? Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, 1st and 2nd Timothy, Titus, Philemon, Hebrews, James, 1st and 2nd Peter, 1st and 2nd 3rd John, Jude, and Revelation. All right. Good job, y'all. We'll keep working on that. What else we got? Oh, yes. And then we talked about the three dispensations. There's another way in which to understand the divisions of the Bible. This one has to do more with the particular covenants or laws that God gave and the time periods that they were to be kept. I noticed this little note in the corner here, dispensation, a period of time that a divine law is in force. So in this particular time, the patriarchal dispensation, there was no written law. Law was spoken to the fathers who passed it down to their descendants, right? Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. That's what we see taking place there, all the way to Moses. From Moses to Christ, we see there was written law, the Old Testament given at Sinai, that was given in these commandments and oracles, and they were expected to abide by it. We see Sabbath worship being established there in Exodus chapter 20, to remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. I made the point this past week with someone, which Sabbath? Well, it was necessarily inferred, right, every Sabbath, right? That's what God was saying. He expected them to read these words, to make the right conclusions from these words and abide by them. And that would take place all the way until Christ nails it to the cross and establishes his church in Acts chapter 2. And then we see the written law that we're governed by is the New Testament. We have a Sunday worship versus a Sabbath one, right? That's what's binding upon us as Christians today, the first day of the week. Which one? Well, just like remember the Sabbath, it's everyone, every first day of the week. And this will remain true until the end of time. So just another way to shore up in your mind then the divisions in regards to which laws are binding. Any comments or questions about this?
Did we ever get this sent out? This like a slide?
You know, did I send it out? I can't remember. I may not have. I thought I might have, but I did eventually print a copy. Does anybody else want a hard copy? I realize that you got a bunch right here. Okay, you just go ahead and hand them on down, and anyone that wants one can take one. If you want a digital copy, I can make sure I can take a snapshot and text it to you or anything like that to get it to whoever wants a digital copy. Okay, any other questions about this? All right, let's go into what I wanted to talk about today. I don't know if we'll get completely into all of this. I might pause and break through it because I might want to talk about some other things as well. We'll just see how we do for time. I want to talk about the various types of literature. Again, talking about the Bible from a higher standpoint. Before we really can understand the Bible or interpret the Bible, it's really important that we understand the type of literature that's being used as we're reading. And that's really true about any kind of literature, if you think about it. There's certain conventions or rules that help us, that govern that type of literature so we can understand it and what it means. For example, I don't know if any of you used to read comic books. I sure did. I have a whole bunch. Julie wishes I'd get rid of them. They're taking up space in my upstairs room. But when you read comic books, there is a certain convention to understand this type of literature. So at the top you have their web head, you've tangled with me once too often. This is time you're gonna be shattered by the shocker. And then Spider-Man says he's right. Once I hit those whirling dynamo blades, it'll be goodbye, Spidey. Question. Did Spider-Man say those words? Why no, Isaiah? The bubble. That's right. So this convention of literature to express a thought was in this particular way versus what Shocker was saying with what he was saying. And then to really illustrate that he's kind of screaming that second part, you kind of see the, you know, the bubble and its jagged edges. How would you know if a narrator was talking? I don't have that on the page. How would you know if a narrator was talking? Yeah, that's right. Meanwhile, back at the, right? And it's just the square there. And so to understand a comic book, you've got to understand some of these conventions to get the point. Here's another illustration. I think you guys might find this one interesting. I'll give you 20 seconds to look at it, just think about it, and see if you can understand it. You get that, Austin?
No.
See, without the rules, we can't understand it, right? So let's talk about this. We might call it a learning a new genre if we were to try and understand this here. We can see, okay, there's some capital letters, there's periods, commas, there's sentences. There seems to be some form of a sentence here. There's capital letters within the sentence. That sometimes indicates a name, right? Quotations, as if someone is speaking. We just don't know what they're saying. You know, we often read by just looking at a page and reading it in our head. But this particular literature is made to be enunciated, to be understood. So let's try that. Once upon term, der Wustard Lettel Gull, who lift Witter Mudder in her Lettel Cordage, honor itch off lodge Doc Florist. If you were to say it enough times, and maybe a little bit faster, you'll hear this. Once upon a time, there was a little girl who lived with her mother in a little cottage on the edge of a large, dark forest. Disc Lattle girl often worry, putty Lattle rot, cluck wetter Lattle rat hut, and fur disc raisin and pimple, colder Lattle rat rotten hut. This little girl often wore a pretty little red cloak with her little red hat, and for this reason, people called her Little Red Riding Hood. One morning, what's that? That one's easy, right? One morning, right? Little Rat Rotten Huts, we know as Little Red Riding Hood. Murder, that sounds like mother, right? Colder Inset. Let's see. One morning, Little Red Riding Hood's mother called her Inset. See? Lattle rat rotten hut, hair say lattle baskin, winsome burden barter and sugar cookies. Little Red Riding Hood, here is a little basket with some bread and butter and sugar cookies. This is not a foreign genre. There's even made a game for it, right? Mad Gab. Some of you probably have it and played it. You know, you say it enough times, you say it fast enough, and you begin to hear it. It's about what you hear, not as so much what is being written down or said. So there's another example. If we don't understand the rules and the conventions that govern that, we're not going to really understand the message. So it's no different when it comes to the scriptures as well. And there are different types of literature in scripture. For example, there's historical narrative, there's poetry, there's prophecy, and then prophecy has different components, like a forthtelling or foretelling, an apocryphal. More on that in just a minute. There's letters as well. And all of these are written in kind of a different way. And to understand the rules of that particular literature, it's not going to open up its message in its fullness, or we might misinterpret certain things as well. Comments, questions about any of this, Paul?
Well, I'd say some of these younger kids like yours need to take an advanced English class in their school if it's available so that they can understand the meaning and how many different meanings one word may have in Scripture that would help them understand better and follow along.
That's true.
Now.
Yeah. I mean, there's always different conventions to learn. Yes.
Well, too, one of the things that the kids and I talked about last quarter was, you know, some of the words in the Bible have a different meaning from what we, you know.
Absolutely.
Today. Like we talked about the word tribute. Like we think about a tribute as, you know, you're honoring somebody, giving them accolades.
Right.
What they've done. But in the Bible, it's, you know, paying a tax or something like that.
Right. Very true. And with all of these, whichever they are, we always have to go back to what it would have meant to the original audience. That's the only way we understand what it can mean for us today. Too many want to cut that process out, and then they misunderstand the scriptures. So what this particular thing would meant to them, then we can begin to understand what it means to us. So these are, and there's probably a few extras. I just kind of put some of this together rather quickly. But these were one of the main ones that came up to my mind that we really need to understand some rules and guidelines about governing them. So, for example, a historical type of literature. Genesis, right? I mean, a very historical book. God even describes it that way. If you look there in Genesis chapter 2. And verse 4. Genesis 2:4, it says, "This is the history of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. And so it's written in often narrative type form, story format, to reveal these are the things that happened, that took place. God, in these historical books, is often unfolding his plan for man. That's why I leaned heavily upon that when it came to the scheme of redemption, showing how God was working with man through time to reveal his plan. Context always affects the application as well. For example, we talked about the dispensations, right? The various laws that were expected for each one, patriarchal. God spoke to the father's house, and then those are the laws they had to obey. So when I read, build yourself an ark of gopher wood, I know he's not talking to me, right? Because context affects the application. That was a patriarchal thing that was taking place. Now, there may be principles that we can learn from that, right? Such as respecting God's authority, being obedient to the commands that are given. Those are principles we get from Noah's story. And the principles may be enduring, but not necessarily that commandment, you see? So context affects the application. In the New Testament, approved things give us a pattern to follow. That's something that God is trying to teach us, is through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Acts, very historical type writings. Here's the things that took place. Here's the things that were done. I approve of these things. Do these things. Even if he doesn't say that verbatim. Philippians chapter 3, verse 17. The Apostle Paul says, "Brethren, join in following my example, and note those who so walk as you have us for a pattern." So he has been saying here by a direct statement, look at our example, our historical precedent that has taken place. The things that the early church did, we seek to do, unless we cannot do, right? Such as, you know, modern miracles and these kinds of things. We understand from other scriptures why that's the case. But those things that are within our ability, we seek to do to the best of our ability as well. And then also understand, again, context affects the application. Who it's being written to, right? Is this in the context of an individual doing their Christian duty? Or is this in the context of the church doing a churchly duty? Those things also make a difference as well. Sometimes you'll run into people who say, well, whatever the individual can do, the church can do. You don't find that in Scripture. You see patterns established and what God expected each one to do. Now, we actually find Scriptures to the contrary. I'll give you one example. Matthew chapter 18. Okay, so in the case when a person sins against you, and it's a brother, so we're talking about two Christians, and there has been a personal transgression from one to the other. So we would say an individual case. Verse 15, "Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone." Okay? This is something God expected an individual to do. You handle it, don't let it get out, right? This can be, what is the old phrase saying, nipped in the bud. It doesn't have to spread, doesn't have to cause division or dissension. It can be handled. However, he says, if he hears you've gained your brother, but if he will not hear, take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. Okay? So now we went from the context of one individual Christian, the problem couldn't be solved. So the individual Christian then goes and gathers two or three more individual Christians. so that they may assist in trying to restore this wayward brother, this sinning brother. Now, again, we see a distinction. God didn't say that those two or three more all of a sudden constituted the church action. That's not church action. It's still individual action. How do we know? Because the next verse says, and if you refuse to hear them, then you tell it to the church. So the Lord has established patterns, and it's important for us to then observe them, see what they did, and if they met God's approval, then we're to follow suit in the same way, whether it's as an individual or whether it's as a church. And that's why it's important we study, so we can delineate some of those patterns and understand them. let's see.
Would that be considered part of the canonical law as far as understanding its words? And, you know, a lot of the theologians use the chronological linguistics to determine when that type of event happened in the scriptures, you know, to make it genuine or authentic, to know that it was in that time period.
Well, okay, so when you speak of canonical, you're talking about something that was in time eventually proved and put into practice, okay? We have to be careful because there is what's called often church tradition that's not necessarily biblical tradition. We as a Church of Christ are concerned about what's biblical tradition because that does not always line up with canonical or church tradition. So some would argue that the reason why we have some of the Bible in the canon is because of what was made canonical by the church. I don't believe that. I believe what we find in the Bible is by God's providence that he allowed to take place. Now, he may have used individuals in the church, but it wasn't because of them. And what you begin to see is that there's many others that may not have fit in the, quote, church tradition route that recognize these were inspired books. And so it is kind of a different tangent than what we're talking about. What I'm talking about is how we establish authority and how we know what is approved to do today and what is not. And we'll actually get more into detail about that in further lessons. But what I just wanted us to see was that it's important for us to pay attention to the details of the historical writings and understand that context does affect the application, right? So there's, let me give you another example. There's times where we see Jesus, and you know what he's doing? He's going on the Sabbath into a synagogue to worship. Okay. Does that mean that's what I need to do because I saw Jesus doing that? Why do you say no?
Because he was before the church was established.
Okay. There you go. That's right. So the context was he had to keep the law perfectly to satisfy its requirements. So that's why he had to do that. But he came to establish a new covenant, right? And we read then of those of the pattern, right, of that those Christians worshiping on the first day of the week. That's why we do that, even though Jesus did something different. So context does affect the application to us. Any other questions about historical type? Okay. It's generally one of the easier types to understand. You can read it, understand it literally. It rarely uses figurative language. And so it's a little bit easier to grasp and understand. My kids always loved it when I did like the series on David. You know, that's historical literature, and you're unveiling the story that God had given. Okay, so another type of literature is poetry. Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Solomon. So this does use figurative language. It's not always meant to be understood literally, right? When Solomon refers to his beloved as a flower, right? He didn't marry a daisy out there, right? What is he trying to mean by that? What do you think?
Beautiful.
So it's emphasizing beauty. Delicate, right? Maybe colorful, bright. So it's the symbol that signifies what he's trying to get at, the meaning. And poetry is often filled with a lot of that. Poetic language has rhyme and parallelism and rhythm and repetition. And each one of these kind of have different ways to understand it. You'll see it a lot in the Proverbs, right? A certain line statement and then a certain contrasting statement. You see that in the Psalms a lot as well. Let me give you one example. Let me find it here in the Proverbs. There's one that I like to use. All right, Proverbs 26. So I want to mention this as well. The Proverbs are generalizations and axioms, not absolutes. That's important to understand, right? And here's a good way to illustrate it. In Proverbs 26, verse 4, "Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him." Then verse 5 says, "Answer a fool in his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes." So this is a perfect way to illustrate. They're not absolutes. They're generalizations. That there are some times when you should not answer a fool. Just don't even jump in the same boat as him. But then there are some times where you do need to answer a fool. It just depends. And so God didn't ask us to check our minds at the door, but to actually utilize them to recognize, okay, by this wisdom he's granted me, which one do I go? Which route should I take, right? Another example is Proverbs 22:6, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old he should not depart from it," right? It's a great generalization and truth. And by and large it's true, but it's not always true, right? Because there are some children that are trained that way and they go astray. But just because there are some exceptions does not negate the rule, right? We might have a saying, what's the saying about, early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise, right? It's a generalization. It's a generalization. No, so he was the exception, you see. He went to bed early, right? He went to bed early, did everything right. Just didn't show in the pocketbook, right? So there's some where it doesn't work that case. But the idea is we're recognizing, okay, generally this is a good principle to live by and it's going to be true. And so Proverbs are a lot like that. And it's important for us to understand that. Ecclesiastes has a lot of that as well. And so we want to make careful we don't press it to the absolute, lest we then damage what God was actually trying to get across to us. Remember, like you said, the comic book, right? The bubbles. We don't want to say Spider-Man was saying that because it was the bubbles. It was the thought, right? So it's the same way. We don't want to say God's making this an absolute when we understand this poetry-type literature. Not written to be understood like that. Okay? All right, what else we got? Prophecy. Okay. Isaiah through Malachi, Book of Revelation as well. So there's forthtelling where the prophet is speaking a message from God almost very plainly. Often the Old Testament prophets were speaking a message to cause the audience to repent. Right? And they would just say it very plainly. You need to repent. You need to get your life straight. You need to get back to serving God. So they were a prophet, but they were forthtelling, telling what needed to be done. But then oftentimes a prophet might foretell, right? Speaking of things to come, looking to something that hasn't happened yet in his time, but God had inspired him. One day it would be true, right? And you'll notice I put from the time of the author, from the future of the author. Because just because something's from the future of the author doesn't mean it's in our future. Right? The prophets spoke in the future. Isaiah 9, right? One day, behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a child. That was the future for Isaiah. But is it our future? It's our past, right? It did happen. It did come to pass. Just not in our future, but in our past. But it was in Isaiah's future. The same is true when it comes to the book of Revelation. Most all of that is fulfilled, I believe, in the first couple of centuries. And you see him speak about these things unfolding and taking place. And when you look at Roman history, you see indeed a lot of these things did happen to the Roman Empire. So though he speaks in a future of language, doesn't mean it's our future. Could be our past as well. Now, I understand that a lot of people interpret Revelation, even the first chapters, the beginning chapters, as still yet to come, right? And I think we run into problems with that, because then a lot of the message would have had no application to the first hearers of John, if it still hasn't even been fulfilled, even in our lifetime. But, nonetheless, these are things that are important for us to understand if we want to understand the message that's being spoken of. Symbolism is often used as a figure of speech and should not be understood literally. The point of the symbol is the message. Like we had mentioned about the flower. My beloved is like a flower, right? Well, it's the very point of the symbol that he's trying to get across. What that meant, that's the message. And we have to try to understand that. Now, I want to say this as well. The book of Revelation, because I know that's one that a lot of people are always interested in. It has a ton of signs and symbols that without a firm grasp of Old Testament prophets, you're not going to be able to understand. And I think that's the problem, is that a lot of people try to interpret Revelation without understanding what some of the Old Testament prophets meant when they used some of those same signs and symbols. So it gets back to what we said at the beginning. To understand the message, we always got to understand what it meant first to the audience that it was written to. Otherwise, we're just not going to get it. Or we might try to get it, but we're going to misinterpret. And that's not what we want to do. All right. I think I got one more here. I might just make it in time. Types of literature, letters, Romans through 3 John, right? Jude, I should have put Jude in there as well. It's personal correspondence between an individual and a group, right? Maybe a church or maybe another individual like Philemon or Titus. And it's often addressed a particular circumstance. We may not know exactly what that circumstance was, but usually as we begin to read the letter, it starts to come out. Okay, they had some of these questions. Okay, they had some of these problems. And now Paul is trying to address those issues, or Peter in his letter, or Jude in his letter. Now, when you write a letter to somebody, right, you're thinking about that person. For example, sometimes I get letters from people, and some are very kind, or, you know, think about me and my mom and different things, and so they're writing with that in mind, right? I'm praying for you. Whatever I can do to help you will be, you know, these kinds of statements are being mentioned. It's very personal. And I want to say that that's the same with letter type format. And can you see how that is different than like writing history or writing poems? So there is this personal touch that God has chose to use to, in essence, really address what he wants in churches today. I think that's interesting. Because you see almost a closeness of God coming from Old Testament to finally the end of the New Testament. As if there's this personal touch. I know you. I know what you're struggling with. I know. Here's where you've gone wrong. You need to correct this, right? And God chose this type of literature to disseminate a lot of what church is supposed to do. Like Paul told Timothy, I write so that you know how to conduct yourself in the house of God. It's not these four walls, but as we come together as a church, right? And so he talks about elders. He talks about deacons. He talks about worship. He talks about, you know, who can lead in worship, various kinds of things. God chose to express that through personal letter, as if he's writing to family. And I think that's a blessing. I think it's a neat thing. But it's important that we understand that, that there is this personal touch in a letter, and that we should seek to understand it, because he is asking us to do things by that, right? Now, he didn't say, you over there at 31W North Church of Christ in Franklin, Kentucky in the year 2025, I want you, right? He didn't have to say that. He was writing to churches in Galatia and Ephesus and Rome, but we are to, by necessary inference, right? We necessarily infer, oh, he's also expecting this at the 31W North Church of Christ in Franklin, Kentucky. You see that? So we draw these conclusions because he sent these very personal letters to these churches or to these individuals, and that's how he wants us to live the Christian life. So you see these different genres. And if we can understand each one in their place, it helps us understand what we're actually reading a lot better. Comments? Questions?
I was just thinking, you know, he established the church, but then he didn't leave us hanging.
That's right. That's right.
He gave us everything we need.
Very good. Yes, Judy.
Say, just don't give up, because don't harden your heart like Pharaoh. If you get frustrated or too frustrated, say, I'm done. I've seen people do this.
Yeah.
I can't do it anymore. And they leave the church. God will make a way for you.
Yeah.
There's a way. And don't say, well, I'm done with that. I'm going to harden my heart more. And then I'll harden my heart more. So soon you do have a hardened heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Press on, like Hebrews says.
That's right.
Press on to that calling, you will make it.
That's right.
I mean, I can't say, don't let no one despise my youth anymore. But I knew what he meant.
Yeah.
I'm great to see these young men pressing on.
Yeah. You're right. It's a big book. But it could have been a whole lot bigger, right? But it does take a lifetime to say. I think, was it Raymond that said, like, you know, it took me all my life to understand that part, right? Because someone said, how can I understand that too? Well, it does. You just keep studying. You just keep learning. You understand more of these kind of rules of convention. You understand the bigger picture. Things in time come together, but you cannot supplant time. It does take time. That's right. All right. Any other final thoughts? Yes?
Kind of going back to the chronology of everything, it's kind of interesting, because I know when we were studying the Kings, to look at the minor prophets, and you kind of get an idea of the prophet and his personality a little bit, and then, you know, you can see more of what's happening with particular kings and nations and such.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just kind of interesting, too, instead of it all being right there together, you know, for some reason I found it.
Right. Very good. I do want to add one more thing, and because I know a number of you are very hungry, wanting to learn more, and a lot of you are using tools that you have, right, such as the internet, Google searches, you know, I want to know about this. And you, if you've done that, you know there's a whole host of different things that are out there. You can probably see 26 takes on baptism, you know, 49 takes on the Lord's Supper or the Eucharist or whatever. There's all these kinds of things. And so it become difficult for a New Testament Christian trying to say, I really would like to find a trusted resource, right? Now, we have to understand, just like when you listen to me, you need to make sure you're following the Bible, because I could be wrong. So we always recognize that man indeed can be wrong. But oftentimes when we find material, religious sources among brethren, that it has a better chance of being right, right? Or at least on track, on target. And so there is a website that I often will use if I'm looking for more information by, again, trusted writers, trusted resource. And that's truthmagazine.com. And it has a search engine there. And you click the search and you can type in Lord's Supper. And then it'll have like 20 articles written by somebody who was a brother in Christ about the Lord's Supper. That's truthmagazine.com. It's a very good resource. Again, I'm not going to say I agree with everything that's said there. And so you still have to take it in light of the Bible. But you're going to have a lot more conservative material that's right on track by members and preachers of the Church of Christ that would teach on various different subjects. If you're low tech and not high tech, I actually have, let me just get it real quick. I have right here in this room in, next to the baptistry, I don't know, 40 or 50 different volumes, different years of Truth Magazine. What I gave you on the website is basically this archived. But if one was low tech, they can even look and, hey, oh, here's on the back of each volume is a topical index. And so one might say, okay, I'm looking for, you know, topics here on worldliness, right? And so you'll see the various articles on worldliness, and you can turn to those pages and you can find them. And those are all there, again, if anyone wants to borrow any of that. I appreciate seeing the hunger and thirsting for righteousness. And I also appreciate that we're only doing this once a month. And so you may want additional study helps and materials. So I just wanted to point some of that out to you. It's either back here or on that website. Any other questions before we stop? Because we're about time to start for other services. All right. Thanks, everybody, for being here. I appreciate it. Good job, Grayson. 17 time periods, buddy. Yeah. Way to do it.
Last month, I skipped it because I was ready.
Oh, were you?
I've been practicing it, yeah.
Oh. Well, I appreciate you working hard on it. Good job.